Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, joined as always by Ian Dark and Joe Rawling. And we have a special guest all the way from the USA. We have Colonel Bob Sheridan, one of the voices of boxing, a man who's covered some 10,000 fights, which might be even more than Ian and John put together. I'm not quite sure, but it's a lot of fights over several generations. How did you get your start in broadcasting?
Well, I was blessed with a tremendous lack of ability to play baseball, and I was too frightened to steal, and so I decided I'd get into broadcasting, and I went back to school, studied reading out loud, and started at an FM station back before FM was even popular. And within 6 months, I had a job at the 50,000-watt station at WGBS in Miami. And the producers there wanted me to find out if I could do anything to do the telecast, or rather the broadcast of the Tuesday night fights from Miami Beach, which, of course, were run by Chris Dundee, the brains behind Muhammad Ali, Brother Angelo, who's very well known. And Chris was like the guy behind the screen in The Wizard of Oz. He pulled all the strings in boxing. And I had met Chris a few years earlier when I was playing baseball at the University of Miami. And it was the Ali fight between he and Sonny Liston. And they called over and asked our coach if they could send some kids over to sell some Coca-Cola. Of course, I jumped at it. I had never seen a professional boxing match. Went over there, and I'm looking around. I'm saying, what the heck is all this? And after selling Coca-Cola for about an hour, I sat down in the corner when the big fight came up, and I was in 15 feet from the action, and I watched the fight from right there, and it was the most exciting thing that I'd ever seen in my life. And who would have known that 3 years later I'd be calling fights for Chris Dundee?
Tell me, Bob, I mean, you're known for so many great calls of so many big fights, but let's go to the Rumble in the Jungle, because, you know, that's going to live in all our memories forever. What was that like being around that fight? I mean, I covered a lot of big fights, but the one I always wished I could have covered was that one in Zaire.
Well, I'll tell you, it was very, very exciting to be there. It was the second trip over to Zaire, because on the first week that I was doing pro football at the time as well, and the Miami Dolphins were playing the Jets in New York, and they had the press flight going from New York that evening to Iceland of all places, and then on to Trier, Germany, to pick up the rest of the press boys from Europe, and we were going down to Zaire on President Mobutu's Air Zaire 747. And in the meantime, I had heard that George Foreman was cut in training. And as soon as I heard that, I said, I'm not going down there, because this fight's gonna be postponed for sure. He's not gonna have a fight in 3 days after being cut in training. And I couldn't at that stage, you know, I was doing the nightly sports in Miami. I was doing the Dolphins. I was doing University of Miami football. And I just couldn't take off to do one boxing match for 6 weeks. And that's approximately what it took to get that fight together 6 weeks later. And I'll tell you this, if that fight had been one day later, it never would have happened, because on the night right after the fight, the heavens opened up and every cable, everything that was on the ground was under 6 or 7 inches of water. So that they never would have got on the air.
Bob, were you close to Foreman or Ali back in the day?
Well, I was very close to Muhammad because, you know, I work with the Dundees. So I had all full access to Muhammad. And, you know, he was a guy that in training worked extremely hard. Nobody ever saw it because he would work in his training room after the exhibition he more or less put on and for his training session. Then he'd go back in the little dingy. I mean, it's unbelievable what a dirty place it was. And he'd get on the end of a training bench and he'd do sit-ups where his trunk actually went over the edge of the training table. And this Cuban by the name of Luis Soria, he was his trainer. And Ali would do 1,000 sit-ups every day training to get his stomach in condition for this fight. And Soria would rub his stomach and with liniment. And I knew that Ali was extremely strong and ready for this fight.
Yeah, but he was a 4-1 underdog, wasn't he, for the fight? There weren't many people who thought he was going to win because, you know, Foreman was regarded at the time as a bit of a monster, maybe even invincible. So what he did in the ring that night, I reckon that goes down as the most audacious strategy that any fighter ever came up with in boxing history. To lay on the ropes like that and let Foreman tee off on him, block it all, tire him out, and then take him out.
And Ian, Andy, and his record coming into that fight, Ali, I mean, it was hardly impressive, was it? He'd had the win and the loss against Ken Norton, who Foreman had done in two rounds. He'd been taken the distance by somebody called Rudy Lubbers, you know, which was a case of who's he. And then the win against on points against Joe Frazier. I mean, it was hardly the sort of thing to encourage a lot of confidence.
Yeah, and he was 32 years old, of course, by then as well, which in those days, I mean, fighters are maybe a better condition and last longer, but you were regarded as pretty old at 32. And of course, it wasn't the Ali of his youth who was all about speed and reflexes. This was a slower version, wasn't it, Bob?
It certainly was. And the strange thing about it was, you know, I did the fight when he fought Rudy Lubbers in Jakarta, Indonesia. And Rudy Lubbers was just a journeyman heavyweight, really. And, you know, King came up with the idea of taking it worldwide. And they conned the people in Jakarta to host the fight there, which they made millions selling it worldwide. So, I mean, this was the genius of Don King, the international promoter. And as a matter of fact, the fight in Zaire wasn't promoted by Don King. It was promoted by two guys by the name of Hank Schwartz and Barry Bernstein, who were actually engineers that invented rear screen projection that made it possible for people around the world to watch the fight live. And at the same time, you know, even though I did all those fights, you couldn't hear a word I was saying, because when you do a fight that's live, you can't hear the commentator because the people react as it is live, just like they would at the arena. If I was calling a fight and you're at the arena, you wouldn't hear a word I was saying.
So, Bob, going back to the fight and Ali's tactics, were you aware of what he was going to do ahead of time with the rope-a-dope, or was it news to you as you watched it?
It was news to me, although, you know, in thinking back to his training, I knew he had trained tremendously for the midsection of his body. And then I remember it was the late evening, and Angelo Dundee was messing around with the ropes. And everybody said he was tightening the ropes. And in fact, he was loosening the ropes, which I did see. I never pointed that out until I realized in the first round what was going on. Because Ali just leaned up against the ropes and let Big George just pound the daylights out. Now, remember, Ali and I did the fight in Caracas, Venezuela in March of 1973 when Big George just wasted Kenny Norton. And Kenny Norton, as a matter of fact, big Marine, he beat Ali three times. Now, he didn't get the score three times, Yeah. First time was in San Diego where he broke Ali's jaw. And of course, they said there was a tooth missing, which I never saw. And then the next thing, he fought him in California, and he absolutely won that fight. But Angelo Dundee trained, he and Sugar Ray Leonard, for that matter, where Chris Dundee would sit in the corner with a stopwatch, and with 15 seconds to go, he'd tell the fighter 15 seconds, and the fighters would put on the, you know, which became known as the Ali Shuffle, that Ray Leonard did better than Ali.
Yeah.
And they stole rounds that in the close rounds, you know, a fighter, and that's why there can be controversy in scoring, because in close rounds, the crowd is going nuts, and one guy has actually won the round, and at the end of the round, everybody's going crazy, cheering for the guy that just did the Ali Shuffle, and he gets the round.
Yeah.
And that's what happens in close rounds. And, you know, I've always said when I'm on the air, and Ian, you know, he made some of the great calls in boxing, and I've always admired Ian's work because, you know, I get a chance to see Ian regularly because I follow Premier Soccer, as we call it, on Sunday mornings over here. And what a great talent Ian is, and what a great boxing commentator he was. But in my day, we had Reg Gutteridge, Harry Carpenter, all of those guys. And I will tell you a story about we're over there on the second day. We're in Zaire. Now, you got to understand, most of the media is down at Nasseli, which was President Mobutu's palace where Ali was training. And I didn't care about being around Ali. Most of the British press boys had the same exposure to Ali as I did because they're on the inside with Angelo and Chris. So we all stayed at the Memling Hotel in downtown Kinshasa. Which was an intimidating place to stay because you didn't see one white face. Now, this was a different time in history. And you can understand how the black man of the 50s and 60s would be intimidated by being around all white people, because when you're in a situation where the only other white people you saw were the guys from the British press corps. And I remember Rich Gutteridge on the second day we were there, I said, "Hey, Richie, what are we doing? Listen to this crap about President Mobutu." And he looks at me, he says, "Well," he says, "Bob," and I wasn't a colonel then. He says, "Well, Bob, I'll tell you this." He says, "See the guy in the end of the row with the submachine gun?" And I said, I looked down and I go, "Yeah." He said, "That's why I'm staying here," in his finest Cockney accent. I said, "Reg, I'm with you."
But there was another great Reg story with George Foreman, which I think both of you probably heard somewhere down the years, where Foreman is doing, I mean, he's being a bit surly, as he could be, in, you know, the first invention of Foreman before he came back as the lovable guy later on. And he's with the British press and he's not enjoying the questions at all. And he said, he suddenly kind of loses it and says to them all, "He goes, you guys are asking me all these questions. You're not tough. You don't know what it's like to get it in a ring." And he didn't know that Reg Gutteridge, of course, had one wooden leg from fighting in the Second World War. So Reg is pretty fed up by it, picks up a knife off the table and puts it, like, stabs his wooden leg with it. Foreman doesn't know it's wood. He goes, "You think you're tough, George? What about this then?" Foreman goes, "You guys are crazy. I'm out of here." It's a great story. All the reporters of that era tell it.
Well, Reg was one of the great characters. And that's the thing, you know, fellas, that I love about boxing. I mean, having a beer with John Rollins is a real trip. And John was a young cub with the BBC. And he'd be out there. And all the British press boys, we Americans would hang out with the British press boys as opposed to our own American guys, because you guys all had great expense accounts. So we
Don't tell everyone.
Yeah, but you did in comparison to us, John. You remember the great nights we used to have with the Skyler and Putnam at the local public houses around town. And
the Flame. Remember the Flame, Bob? The Flame in Vegas?
That was it, the Flame. That was the very restaurant.
Yeah.
And that was our hangout. and it was a lot of fun. But in those days, the television guys didn't really drink. They didn't enjoy what they were doing. They actually took it like it was for real. And the whole thing's an act. I mean, it's boxing. It's a show. It's all bullshit. And the only thing that's real is when the bell rings to start the first round, and then it gets real in a hurry. But anyway, we had dozens of stories we go on like that. It happened in Zaire when we fixed up one of your press guys with a transvestite. And I won't go into who that was, but it wasn't John Rawlings. No,
I think you better not. Do you remember? I mean, you're talking about the press corps, but you know, I mean, it's famously now, you know, Norman Mailer and George Plimpton were, you know, among the press corps, weren't they, for the Rumble in the Jungle?
Yeah, they were. I mean, everybody who was anybody tried to find an excuse to be there. Like at the first Frazier fight in New York, Frank Sinatra all of a sudden became a photographer for Life magazine. Ridiculous. Yeah. And Sinatra, while I'm talking about him, what a jerk. I mean, a great, can you say bad things on the air on these podcasts?
Yeah, he's the biggest asshole. You just did, Bob. You just did.
He's the biggest, let me expound it. Frank Sinatra was the biggest asshole I ever met in my life in the entertainment business.
Why do you say that?
Well, I'll give you an example. Let's take the Ali fight against Larry Holmes. Okay, I'm sitting there. I got my bodyguard. Some of you guys remember Pancho Limón, 7'2". About 600 pounds, with the largest Mexican in captivity. And I would have him at ringside because in boxing, like no other sport, especially outside of Nevada, you get people just walk down while you're on the air and start talking to you like, you know, they're part of the broadcast. Excuse me, talking to a billion people here. Do you mind if I finish the broadcast before I invite you in? And, you know, so you don't have to get into that stuff. You have a security guy there. Well, I didn't need a whole staff like they had at HBO or Showtime because I had Pancho. So anyway, Sinatra comes in. He says, "Hey, kid," he says to me, he says, "get me and my boys, Jilly, in the crowd. Get them some seats." And I stand up immediately. And I said, "Hey, I don't know who the hell you are." Of course, I knew well who he was because I'd heard he was coming. I said, "I don't know who the hell you are or who you think you are, but get your own seat." I said, he said, "I'm Frank Sinatra." I said, "Well, I haven't a clue as to who Frank Sinatra is, but right now you're the biggest asshole I ever met in my life." And that started a little fracas at ringside. I said, "Sinatra, what are you, a greaseball? You Italian?" And he says, "Yeah," he says. I said, "Well, I'm Irish and we don't take too good to Italians anyway," which is part of my street background. And in reality, we love Italians and we love everybody because as long as we know we get our next shot at Jameson, we don't have an enemy in the world. But anyway, that's the way Sinatra came on to me. So, you know, you're in our kitchen. Ian, John will tell you, when you're sitting down to do a broadcast, that's our kitchen. We control that area. And so yeah. Sinatra, who never did a live telecast in his life, I don't even think he could do a live one because he had to read everything off teleprompter. And anyhow, that's how that started out. And I made him look like a total idiot on the air. I'd ask him questions that, you know, I'd go like, "Well, Frank, what do you think? The counterpunching here, the way he slid to his left, that half step that he took, do you think that was the key to him being able to get the right hand through and then nailing him with the uppercut?" And Frank would be going, You know, I just made him look like an idiot, and which is what my full intention was. I don't get mad, I get even.
I'd love to hear that interview. I would love to have that interview as a treasure and keep it somewhere on at home here.
But, you know, here's a different from that. Chris Christopherson is doing color with me on a fight. And Chris comes in, and Chris was a Rhodes Scholar, He was a captain of the United States Army. He was a real gentleman. He was a superstar entertainer. He was a gifted individual, but more important, just a great guy. And Chris comes in, he says, "Hello, Bob, I'm Chris." He says, "I don't really know what I'm doing here." He said, "My agent got me this gig with Don King, so I'm here." I said, "Chris, don't you worry about a thing." I said, "I'll talk you through the whole thing. And any question I ask you, I'll be assured you'll know the answer to it." And he said, "Thanks so much." And we went through the broadcast. And you'd think Christofferson was the second coming of Howard Cosell.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Just a great guy. That's the difference in personalities and some of the behind the scenes stuff. And the guys will tell you there's so much distraction before you go on the air. And then some guy will say, "Well, he said there were 15,000 people at the fight and there were only 12,000. Well, sorry. And I'm not a crowd estimator. But that's the kind of thing you get criticized on because they don't put erasers on microphones.
Going back to Zaire, Bob, you know, when you did that commentary, we, of course, heard our British commentators and we heard the way they were seeing it. And they couldn't believe what Ali was doing, lying on the ropes. They thought he was committing some sort of boxing suicide. But when I saw your commentary and heard your commentary, I mean, you picked up on it incredibly quickly what he was doing, that it was all part of a tactical master plan. And the others didn't get that. I mean, how did you sort of read that as being the case as quickly as you did?
I had the advantage, John, of knowing what he did in training and then realizing that Angelo was loosening the ropes and not tightening them. And when that was going on, remember doing color in that fight, I had Jimmy Ellis, I had the Godfather of Soul, James Brown. I had Jim Brown, the football player. I had Joe Frazier. I had David Frost.
Yeah.
David was the biggest distraction. Great guy. Don't get me wrong about David, but he was such an Ali groupie. He was a real distraction during the call of the fight. And I get to deal with all this stuff and still call the fight, which in retrospect, I'm thinking, you know, how the hell did I do it? I don't know, but I did. And of course, don't forget, that was my shining moment too. And, you know, they say, you know, you're really lucky to get to call that fight. Well, maybe I was very lucky to get to call it, but you know, the old saying, when you get the opportunity, make sure you're prepared and then the good luck will come to you in a hurry. And that's kind of what happened there.
I love the stories, Bob, about, you know, Ali, you know, as Foreman's unloading on him onto his arms and body, if he ever got through to the body, and he's blocking the shots, and Ali whispers in his ear, "Is that all you got, George? They told me you could punch." I mean, that's just great Ali legend stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, but that all that is true. That's definitely true. I had a problem with the end of that fight because for the first time, because of all of those announces, I was set back off the apron of the ring. And I couldn't hear the guy counting for the knockdowns, nor could I see Zach Clayton when he turned his back to send Ali back to the corner that he had actually continued the count. Usually when you turn around and you send somebody back to the corner, you stop the count until he gets back away and they continue it. So I'm not aware of that. So, and again, Ian, John, they can attest to this. When you're calling live sports, all you can call is what you see, and that's what I did. But I was highly criticized because when the count, if you watch it again, it gets up to 8. I say, and the fight is, I go, 6, 7, 8, and the fight is all over because I see Zach wave his hands like that the fight's over. And, of course, I get criticized for a quick count. And it was anything but that. And of course, nobody asked me the question, which was a better story, was how did that happen? Because the print media, for the most part, doesn't give a damn about the electronic media, especially in those days. And you know, the story was missed, which was a better story than the BS that I missed called the end of the fight. But, you know, I licked my wounds and nobody ever asked me about it. And as I was picking up my check for $35,000 for the fight and another $25,000 for when it came out in the movies the next week. I said, I'll take the missed call.
Wow. Is that what they paid you? That was a good gig, Bob.
Yeah, that was the best gig I ever had in my life at that point.
Wow. You must have had a good agent, or did you do it all yourself?
No, I did it myself, because it's not the type of job you can go and negotiate and say, because they're just looking at you and say, hey, there's a lot of guys that do this fight for nothing. And it's true. And that's true. The problem.
But not as well.
Well, thank you for saying that.
Well, Bob, let me ask you this from pre-fight out in Zaire. Did you feel that there was momentum shifting out there before the fight? I know you said you tried to go out there and then you had to go back. But obviously, Ali seemed to be thriving over there, whereas Foreman went into himself a little bit, didn't he? He got cut and he wasn't popular out there. Did you feel that Ali had some kind of momentum with the people behind him going into the fight, or did you think that just didn't matter?
No, great question, because it absolutely was true. Ali had them mesmerized. He had the local people there who loved Ali. Remember the big chant, Ali Boumaye? Mm. Well, that meant Ali kill him. Yeah. And they were serious. And, Ali had a way with the media. He had a way with the fans. He had a way with the Africa. He had a way with everything he did over there. And he intimidated George. He said to George, you better get your own chefs over here, because the story of them poisoning your food. And he had George afraid to eat for the past week or the previous week to the fight. I mean, he had him psyched inside and out, which basically was the way he talked his way into the Sonny Liston fight, by intimidation, by being a showman. He knew exactly what he was doing. For Ali, when he was in front of the media, the crowd, he was on stage and he loved every moment of it.
And there was that line, Bob, before the fight, that Ali had phoned Customato for advice, and Cus had said, first thing you need to do is go out and hit George with a right hand at the start of the fight. Did you hear that?
I wasn't familiar with that, but that would be Cus, all right.
He did, didn't he? He hit him with a few right leads in the first round before he went on to the rope-a-dope tactic.
Yeah, in retrospect, yeah, you're right. He did. I didn't realize. That's the first time, you think you know the whole story. That's the first time I heard that Cus had anything to do with it. Because Cus was very famous, and you would know this better than me, for what he did with Mike Tyson. He was the trainer of the late, great former commissioner of boxing, and that was Floyd Patterson.
It was great, really. I mean, in later life, Muhammad Ali and George Foreman became pretty big mates. I saw one quote from Foreman saying, there's nobody I love more in this world than Muhammad Ali.
Well, that's great that George came around, but George in the early years had a bad crowd around him. I won't get into the names, but you all know who they are. And George was a, surly guy, and not a nice guy, and not a fun guy. Not the guy that he created, with the hamburgers and the big smile and all the rest of it. Yeah. But he observed that. I remember coming out of one fight. I do remember, I think, well, I can't, no, I don't want to exaggerate because I'm not sure. But I remember George was walking out with his pals and saying, I'm going to get back in the ring. What Ali just did, he said, I can do it. And that was after the fight where he retired on the 17th of March when he saw little baby Jesus.
The Jimmy Young fight.
Right. Jimmy Young fight. And I remember him walking out and saying he was going to change his whole attitude. And he did. And he made a fortune with that hamburger thing and with the George Foreman grill. He made more money with the George Foreman grill than he made in his entire boxing career.
Well, he reinvented himself, didn't he, George?
Oh, totally, totally. And George was then fun to be around, because George was playing a role then, just like Ali was playing a role when he was in front of the public.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll tell you a story. In 73 again in Caracas, Ali is doing color with me, color commentary with me, leading up to the big fight, which was the following fall, which we now know was the Rumble in the Jungle. And so Ali, the whole premise of the fight was to promote the fight coming up in Zaire in the fall. One problem is Foreman knocks out Norton in the second round, so there's no fight. There's no time to promote. So the director says, we get up there, interview Ali, and get him juiced up. But again, this is what was great that I knew Ali, and I said, Ali, how can you tell me that you have any chance against this guy who beat you twice? And he says to me, he didn't beat me twice. I said, that aside, I said, you're always talking about going back to Africa to win the title. He said, whoever told you that? He said, when I get you over to Africa, he says, I'm going to put you in a pot and cook you. So, I mean, that was a great line. And so the producer comes back on, he says, could you get him to say that again? I can't get him to do that again. That was a natural bit. I mean, that's Ali. That's a one-off. And yeah. That, I think, is on film in a few places. I've seen that. And it's funny.
It's funny how much, I mean, he loved all the media guys, didn't he? He especially loved the British press guys. I remember Colin Hart, you know, Colin and Kenny Jones. Apparently they turned up late up at Deer Lake for a press conference. They got delayed. The flights were, you know, all over the place. So they got there in the middle of the night. And the security guy said, you know, what are you doing here? They said, well, we missed the press conference, you know, and we need to get some, you know, a word with Mohammed, you know, first thing in the morning. And the guy said, you know, we have to wait till first thing in the morning. He'll come down. And so at 3 a.m. in the morning, Ali came out of his room and sat with them in the dark, sort of sitting on a rock. And they got far better quotes than the other guys that got earlier on. You know, they got brilliant stuff. But that was apparently, and I mean, I wasn't around, not even I'm that old that I was around for that. But, you know, those stories were told to me by the press guys when I joined the British boxing beat, so to speak.
Kenny, of course, had that kind of power, but a low key guy. I think Kenny was from Scotland, and the other British press guys, Ali loved them because Jimmy Lawton and guys of that, because yeah, they didn't intimidate Ali, they didn't bother Ali, and the British press loved Ali, so all they did was write positive things about him. So how does he react? Well, he loved this. So yeah, he didn't get out of bed for anybody, but especially those guys.
Well, the first time I went over, the first fight I ever covered in America was Larry Holmes, Muhammad Ali. You know, one of the saddest things you ever saw, as it turned out. But I turned up there on the very first day, a pretty naive British radio reporter, and wandered up to where Ali was doing the sparring in front of hundreds of people. And kind of naively, I went up to Angelo Dundee and said, would it be possible for Muhammad to do an interview with me sometime this week? He goes, he shouts out to Ali. He goes, hey, we got a British guy here. We got a British guy here, Muhammad. Ali stopped the skipping and started talking to people. He goes, the only people who know about boxing are the British guys. They're the guys who made me the champion, even when everyone else tried to take it away from me. He goes, we're going to talk to the British guy. We're going to do that now. So he walks over to me. I've not even got tape in the machine ready to do this. I'm trying to arrange something for 2 days' time. I've suddenly got to interview Ali. And that was because, just like I said, the British Boxing Board of Control, you know, when he was banned in the United States because of the draft dodging row, continued to regard him as the world heavyweight champion. They weren't going to change their mind about it. He never forgot that.
No, he didn't. And that's the way a champion should lose. There shouldn't be any political crap that a guy can lose his title outside the ring for a political purpose. I mean, the BBC, they were right in that whole issue. And, you know, history now tells us, so was Ali. You know, he was right about it, too.
Yeah.
The whole Vietnam War was a farce, the whole thing.
Yeah. Hey, Bob, let me ask you this. When George Foreman hit the deck and you obviously made your historic call, were you aware of exactly how historic it was, you know, that we'd still be talking about it the way that we are with such reverence with these guys now, John and Ian, who between them have probably 50 years plus of experience, and they still wish that that was the one fight that they've been to. Did you realize it was that seismic, the Rumble in the Jungle?
I really didn't, not at that. You know, sometimes you just thrust into things that happen, and, you know, here we are, 60-some years later, and we're still talking about this fight. No, not to this magnitude ever did I ever dream that the fight would be that big. And the other big fight, of course, was when the title changed hands, and the biggest night of the life in Tokyo, when Tyson, you know, blew his fight against Buster Douglas. Those are two major fights that had historical ramifications, let's say. And no, you don't realize it at the time, but, you know, somehow or other, these fights get bigger. The further away they are, the bigger they get. Yeah. So, you know, it's a lot of fun to think that I was part of all that stuff, and I'll be in the history of boxing for the, you know, from 1966 to after 2022. That represents a long time in the history of boxing, and I'm on some of the greatest fights. Hey, but while we're talking about some of the greatest fights, just to digress for a second, one of the best fights I ever saw took place between Nigel Benn and Gerald McClellan.
Oh.
In that fight, which was in England, Gerald almost had Nigel out in the second round.
Yeah.
And barely did Nigel hang in there.
That was more savage than it should ever be, wasn't it, really? I think, Bob, that fight. I felt uncomfortable watching it. It had gone beyond a line, that. And I felt that a bit as well, watching the thriller in Manila.
I called that in Manila. And it was, I still remember it almost with horror now, Bob. It was a night which kind of touched everything. It was fantastic bravery from both boxers. Ben was inspired, and then of course the awful aftermath of it. And yeah, and as Ian says, that one in Manila, you know, I mean, that was a fight too far for both Frazier and Ali, wasn't it?
Yeah, it
really was. But you know, there's a case of, again, it being live, and it, as it unfolded, I didn't realize what was going on when I saw McClellan up at his eye and pouring like this. And I'm calling it live and saying, I can't believe that this guy's quitting. But I had no way of knowing he was having a stroke. You know, so in retrospect, it was a horrible thing to say. But again, no races on live television, you know.
I did it with Henry Cooper, Bob, and he said exactly the same thing. I remember him saying, well, he didn't say quit. He said he swallowed. You don't want to know. He says he's done him. He's swallowed. Mm. And, you know, and that's with the benefit of hindsight, of course, is so way off mark. But that's what commentary is about, isn't it? I mean, sometimes you do lead with your chin. You know, you just have to call it as you see it. And inevitably, sometimes you get it wrong.
Yeah.
Hey, you gotta put it out there. But Ian, let me ask you this: what's the biggest football match you ever called, and why was it as great as it was?
The one that always springs to mind when I'm asked that was the World Cup game. It just because you knew that people would still be talking about this game 50 years on. The World Cup semi-final. Where Brazil are at home in their own World Cup, and everyone expects them to win their home World Cup. And they're beaten 7-1 on their home soil by Germany in the semi-final of the World Cup. It was just astonishing to watch that unfold in front of you. You said there, Bob, you sometimes realize later on that the event you're talking about has become a huge part of history. I knew then, as I was calling the game, that people would still be talking about that match half a century from now. It was impossible to believe that could happen, that Brazil could be dismantled in front of their own crowd like that by Germany, which they were. I think they scored 5 in 29 minutes or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, if you want one that sticks out, that would be it.
Let me add something on McClellan, by the way. I happily spoke to Lisa McClellan this week, actually. I had a nice conversation with her. Really? She reported very encouraging and nice things about Gerald's health. So he doesn't have his sight, but his hearing is up to speed. And his health is so good, they haven't even been to the doctors in 3 or 4 years. He can stand and walk around the house, but when they go out, he needs a wheelchair, or she makes sure he's in a wheelchair. So I think he's not in fighting shape, but I think the rumours of his demise have somewhat been exaggerated over the years. So it was nice to speak to Lisa and hear that, of course, Gerald needs help, but he's living a life with her support and has been for 27 years now. And
John, you and I could attest to the fact that many a night at the Flame restaurant, we had to take a wheelchair home ourselves.
We had one or two rather good nights. Over there. I hope no BBC accountants are listening into this because
tell the story of the night.
It wasn't always my money I was spending.
No, I know that. You were with BBC then. That was great. Hey, Ian, one last thing I've always wanted to ask you. Why did you leave boxing to just concentrate on football?
Well, you know how it is in our business. You're with various companies and you have contracts with them. And I made a transfer from Sky Sports, where I covered the boxing, to a channel, ESPN, where I was covering the Premier League in America. They had their own boxing setup. So it was a decision I had to take. I had an offer that was too good to refuse. Not as good as your $60,000 to cover the Rumble in the Jungle, I have to say, Bob, but it was a very good offer. And then I got to a point, really, people have asked me to do it again as the years have gone by, but I said, I covered a fantastic era of boxing. Yeah. And I wouldn't want to do it in a worse way. I think you've got to live the sport and be around it all the time. And that wouldn't be possible anymore because I'm getting a little bit too old. I'd be having to do it 24/7,
Yeah. Hey, you had a great color guy with you in Jimmy. What an enjoyable guy he is.
Yeah. He used to do his magic tricks, of course, as well. I don't know if you ever saw any of them.
Oh, yeah.
Jim Watt, yeah.
Just a fun guy to be with.
He was, yeah.
Hey, I'll tell you another fun guy. I'm doing the fight. Lou Savarese and Mike Tyson. We're in Bunny, Scotland. It's raining cats and dogs.
Yeah.
Stevie Collins is doing color with me for, I think, BBC and radio. And it's raining cats and dogs. And all of a sudden, we're off the air. Stevie disappears. He comes back about a minute later, and we're back on the air. I said, what the hell did you do? He says, hey, you didn't know I was a master electrician. I said, no, I knew you were a great welterweight and a great middleweight, but I didn't know you were a master electrician. He says, oh, I got all kinds of skills. Collins was, I talked to him regularly now because we're both in the cattle business, but Stevie is a great friend of mine. And we're trying to angle for him now because he certainly belongs in the Boxing Hall of Fame. And he defeated two guys that are being nominated for the Hall of Fame this year, and he stopped both of them. So Stevie, who by the way serves in the Irish Brigade, I think, of the British Army. Well, I think he's the staff sergeant, but he's very proud to wear the Irish Brigade's outfit, you know?
Still in great shape as well, Steve. Still looks as though he could fight a bit if he had to.
Oh, yeah. Well, when I go drinking in Boston, I take him with me.
Hey, Bob, when we talk about color guys, we mentioned Jim Watt and you said there, Steve Collins. Who have been your favorite guys, color commentators, to work alongside? I mean, you mentioned Ali. That's not a bad one.
I was going to say, you can't beat that.
Ali wasn't a ringer. I would say my favorite guys are Dave Bontempo from ESPN and Benny Ricardo, who is a professional football player and does football commentating in Spanish. And he's got a great sense of humor, and he's a lot of fun to work with, too. and we can get away with because we're on the, internet, and we can get away with a lot of stuff you couldn't get away with on the networks.
Yeah, and I think Dave Bontempo might be on the ballot. Is he for the Hall of Fame, but from the Atlantic City Press for many years?
Yeah, that's Dave. And Dave is a fun guy to be with, too. He and I have got almost the entire dialogue of The Godfather memorized. So he'll call me up, and he won't say a word. He won't say, hello, Colonel, or anything. He'll just go, in my neighborhood, we're not going to have it in the schools. I don't want any churches. We don't. No, he's talking about drugs. And he just goes through the whole bit. These are fun guys you meet during your life. And you know, the most fun guys to work with on the air are guys that aren't impressed with what we do for a living. You know, by the mere fact of what we do, you're going to get famous. And if you let it go to your head, you really lost the fun of it, because we're one in a billion people that get a chance to do this stuff. And you got to remember this. Bob Sheridan without boxing is just another Mick from Ireland that grew up a thug in Boston and became a cattleman. And no more and no less, because that's all I really am. But I love the sport, and I like the notoriety, but I have fun with it. And I know this for sure. It's got nothing to do with anything I've done. It's all just the fun of doing it.
I think it's fair to say you kind of lived the life, didn't you, Bob, without saying too much. You lived the life, but you kind of paid the penalty as well, because you've had your health problems. Just tell us, there's one very famous one. I got, how many heart attacks have we had now?
I'm up to 12 now. And John, that doesn't include the past 12 days, I've been in the hospital 10 days. Oh, I got an infection in my bowel. In my bowel, that's a pretty sight, isn't it? And I ended up in the hospital for 10 days, and I'm just out for 2 days now. So, I'm right back at it. But what are you going to do? You can't lay around and worry about it. I mean, I'm not going to stop smoking cigars, and I'm certainly not going to quit drinking Jameson. And when I'm in Ireland, I'm definitely going to be drinking Guinness. So, I'm not changing my lifestyle. I mean, I'm 80, well, the best part of 80 years old now. I'm actually 78. But the doctor said, if you don't quit smoking those cigars, you don't get another 15 years to live. And let me see, 80, 90, 95. Said, Doc, I think I'll take the 95 because I'm not giving up anything. I've lived the free life of the rover from the Maurice Green Basin to the dusty outback. I waltzed my Matilda all over.
You had the full medical. You had the full medical team at ringside though once, didn't you? Wasn't it the second Tyson Holyfield fight? You actually had a defibrillator and a full medical team at ringside.
Yeah, well, that was the night before I had a heart attack, and so I'm over at the hospital. And I'm thinking, I'm going to get out of here. I've already had the angioplasty. And for anyone who's listening and knows about angioplasties, all they do is they take the junk that's in your arteries and they push it aside with a balloon. But as soon as you can breathe again, you feel great. So you don't know you've been sick. All you know is that you feel like Superman. And so off I go to the fight with my bodyguard Poncho and with my cardiologist, Dr. Ram Singh in tow. And off we went to the fight. We called the fight. And it was funny about that fight. I had no idea about the ear biting or any of that stuff, but Marty Corwin, my producer, who most of you guys know, a producer for a long time with Don King and with Bob Arum. But anyway, Marty says, why don't we do the close now? He said, just give me a generic close. And then as soon as the fight's over, you can get out of here. So I said, okay. So I go and what about the end of that fight? Unbelievable. Who would have believed what Tyson is capable of? From Las Vegas, Nevada, it's the Colonel Bob Sheridan saying, good night, everybody. And off I went. And it fit perfectly.
That's brilliant.
Lucky man.
Well, you're a survivor, Bob. But we're glad you're here.
Be.
You look great. You look great from here.
Well,
and you're down to welterweight.
Hey, Ian, but this is a little muffled video. This is kind of like the video from the first days of the moon.
I can't believe it. You commentated on a big fight the night after you'd had a heart attack.
Yeah, and I went right back to the hospital. You know, everybody, let me tell you the story behind this, because everybody said, geez, how brave was he to do that? I wasn't brave at all. I knew if they get another announcer to go in and do that fight. I've been in Las Vegas, and, you know, I think my fee for that fight was like $5,000 or $6,000. And so I've already blown about $3,000 on the tables. I got to make up with this. I got to go back to Boston with some money. So in reality, if they get somebody else to call that fight, I'm not getting paid. So I said, I got to get out of here and get a payday. And Poncho understood, because if I don't get paid, he doesn't get paid. So that's how that all came about. There wasn't an ounce of bravery involved in it at all. It was strictly the Benjamins.
That's like a DJ that used to be on BBC Radio. Used to have the lunchtime show. He never, ever took a vacation holiday because he was fearful about whoever took over would oust him from the job. So, yeah. But hey, look, they weren't going to replace you, Colonel.
Hey, a couple of the other great guys that I didn't get a chance to mention. Remember Dickie Davies, the presenter?
Yep.
Well, Dickie, before he did that, he was actually the chief purser on the Queen Elizabeth at the time. So we're doing a cruise, and we're having a few drinks. We weren't supposed to be doing a cruise, but we had a few drinks down in Southampton, and we ended up getting stowed on the ship, and took Dickie to get me off. I think we ended up in Norway or someplace, but that's how we get off anyway. But I mean, you just go on and on with these inane stories that, except for the personalities involved, and I mean, nobody over here would know Dickie, but Dickie was some character. He really was.
Oh yeah, he's a lovely guy, Dickie Davies. Very nice man.
Is Dickie still alive?
Yes, he is.
Ah, good. Yep. Hey, when you talk to him, tell him I was asking for him and tell him that story on the air.
Yeah, gentleman, Dickie. And he was much loved in the television business as well.
Yeah.
ITV's main afternoon world of sport for many a year.
And another story about Dickie. We're over in Tokyo. And I get the British press boys with me, and Dickie had arranged for us to go the Queen Elizabeth QE2 was on lease for 6 months to the Chinese, the Japanese, so they could steal all the secrets and rebuild one themselves. And so anyway, he arranges for us to go over with the chief purser on the ship, and we have a great night out. And of course, I get all the British press boys with me because I want to show off. And they, you know, they always call me the Mick or the big Irish guy or whatever, which I revel in. And they go, I said, well, the big Mick has done it this time. We're going on your flagship, and we're going down to the port. We're going to get there at 9 o'clock. We're having a full meal, and then we're going to drink all night with the chief purser, who's a mad British soccer fan, Premier League. And we have some night out. Now, we're stumbling out of there. It's full daylight now. It's about 8 o'clock in the morning as we're trying to get taxis back to the hotel, and word comes down that Cassius Clay died. Oh, Jesus, the guy's going to a full panic. Well, it wasn't Cassius Marcellus Clay, it was his father. So guys were very much relieved when Ali's father died. But that's just a little aside to that story. But what a great night we had on the flagship.
I suppose just picking up from that, Bob, you've obviously seen some of these guys pass away. Obviously, Joe Frazier's no longer with us. We mentioned Sonny Lister at the top. He's gone. Mohammed's gone. You must feel like losing a part of you each time that these guys have left that you've chronicled for decades and decades, right?
Yeah, another one we just lost was Leon Spinks. Mm-hmm. Leon was just crazy. He was, you know, we won the title at exactly the right time. He'd had about his sixth or seventh pro fight, and he runs into Ali, who wasn't prepared to fight him at all, and he wins the title. And of course, he goes nuts afterwards. And Leon's wife put on one of the greatest memorials that I've ever seen in boxing for Leon Spinks. It started about 8 o'clock on a Friday night, and it went on till Sunday, actually Monday morning. And it was just a blown out hoolie, but very, very well done with films and people coming in. And I mean, you couldn't believe that this woman who enjoys a quiet cocktail herself could put on such a tribute to Leon Spinks. And then another one we just lost was Ernie Shavers. Ernie Shavers, I had the pleasure of inducting him into the Nevada Boxing Hall of Fame. And we were very close friends. And Larry Holmes was there that night. And I got Larry to talk about the night that he virtually got knocked out by Ernie Shavers. And Ernie really loved the night. And it's kind of sad to see guys like that go, good guys, you know. Mm-hmm. Muhammad aside, I mean, Muhammad was bigger than boxing, you know.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, you mentioned that when you talk about those heavyweights, and Brenda Spinks is Leon's wife, isn't she, who put on that the memorial. I remember, you know, Leon, Ernie Shavers and Ken Norton used to do a lot of signings on the Las Vegas Strip, didn't they, at different places, and they would ride together and drive together. It's very sad that we've lost all three of them now. Sorry, John.
No, but what you say is so important to be said, because you asked me the question of how do I feel about it, and you know, it's just a sad thing. It's part of life. I mean, one of these days you're going to pick it up and say, guess who dropped dead today? And I'm going to pick up the paper and say, it wasn't Colonel Bob Sheridan, and I'll be smart.
Sorry, John, I just cut you off there.
I was just going to say, you know, I mean, Bob's got this autobiography, which he's going to be bringing out in the new year. And when you look back over all your time, Bob, and all the laughs, all the fun you've had, all the great fights you've seen, all the people who've influenced you and you've met, does Muhammad Ali stand head and shoulders above all of them?
You know, that is the thing that most people would say. But Larry Holmes actually stands head and shoulders. In my mind, I think Larry Holmes is the greatest heavyweight that ever lived. Wow. And I'll tell you why. And, you know, as soon as I say that, and I do it to set up the speeches I give. Oh, this is a good one. You like this, Ian? I get 25 to 50,000 to do his corporate speech.
Oh, wow. Wow.
You don't need the book. You don't need the book.
Yeah, I do.
Sell the movie rights next.
But anyway, Larry got virtually knocked out by Ronaldo Snipes, by Ernie Shavers, and by Mike Weaver. Weaver, I would never forget that because it was on my birthday, the 22nd of June, in Madison Square Garden. And in all three cases, Larry came off the canvas to win the fights, those three fights. No other heavyweight, to my knowledge, that I can think of has ever done that, where he's virtually knocked out and came back to win the fights. Therefore, at the end of my speech, I say, therefore, and I've only called, you know, they used to use the figure 10,000, now I say 15,000 fights. I said, I don't know if you mind if I have an opinion, but, you know, 15,000 fights, I think I earned the right to have at least an opinion. I may not be right, but can I have an opinion? And they all laugh. You know, so I enjoy that part of it. But that's a fact. I think Larry's one of the greatest fighters that ever lived.
He's certainly the most underrated heavyweight, I think, who ever lived.
Yeah, because he came on the heels, Ian, of Muhammad.
Yeah.
I mean, the Lord himself could have come on the heels of Muhammad and they would have said that he was a Jew or something. I don't know.
Bob, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you very much for doing this for us. We definitely want to plug your book, and maybe we'll get you back on when the book comes out officially.
Yeah.
It's great to see you in good form as well. And we're grateful that you've been able to join us.
Hey, boys, listen, anytime for anyone or all you guys together, I appreciate the plugs for the book. And Ian, if I make the kind of money I think I'm going to make with a book, I'll send you a nice honorarium to remind you of the thrilling days of yesteryear.
Yeah, this has been a great pleasure, Bob. Thank you so much. And great to see you.
Me, guys. All the very best. Bye-bye now. Take care, John.
We've got to just give it the big plug. All the King's Horses and All the Queen's Men, the greatest boxing book. Buy it.
Buy it now.
Do you know what? I hope there's a chapter about John Rawley at the Flame in there somewhere.
Yeah.
It might be. You never know. I might add it yet. I'm not done with the book yet.
Okay,
we're giving it another chapter here.
Yeah. Take care, boys. Great being with you.
Thanks for joining us. God, we'll be back soon. Bye-bye.
God bless you, lads.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.